This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Susanna Weiss is a certified sex educator, a sex and love coach, a writer, a speaker whose work has appeared in major outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, Cosmopolitan, and many, many more. She has degrees in cognitive neuroscience, gender and sexuality studies, and modern culture media from Brown University. Susanna combines scientific insight with cultural critique. She works with individuals and couples to overcome shame, improve communication, and cultivate authentic pleasure. Her work spans topics including feminine sexuality, body image, kink, boundaries, and ethical non-monogamy. Susanna's thoughtful, often provocative takes on sex and identity challenge societal norms and invite deeper intimacy, self-knowledge, and joy. I also have to share two amazing books that Susanna's written, I've been lucky enough to read. One called Subjectified, Becoming a Sexual Subject, and Eve's Blessing. And we'll talk about those hopefully later on, if that's okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us from LA. It's incredibly kind of you. I just wanted to start, if it's okay, by taking you back a little bit. So just to understand your teenage, your formative years, would the person you were then recognize the person you are today?
I think she would be proud of the person I am today. Yeah, I write in my book, Subjectify, that's sort of where both books start is my teenage years, where I just wasn't given any information about sex or my own body, and just was very self-conscious, very insecure in my body, had disordered eating and body image issues. And it was really in college, I think, when I started reading feminist books and went to a sexuality workshop and had like my first sexual experiences, which thankfully were positive, that I realized that developing a healthy relationship to your sexuality as a woman is really empowering and really important, because that's your body. That's like where you are. That's where you live all day. And that's actually what helped me to heal from my eating disorder, was realizing my body was meant not to be an object for the male gaze, but to like receive and experience pleasure itself. And so that's kind of how Subjectified, one of the books you mentioned, was born. And then Eve's Blessing was more about, it starts off more with my lack of education about things like periods and first time sex and things we expect to be painful, and how we normalize pain for women in society, and how, again, it was maybe around college or, you know, when I was older that I realized a lot of these ideas are outdated and that women do not have to live in so much pain. And a lot of the pain we experience is cultural rather than biological.
When do you think you first felt comfortable in your body and in knowing your own body?
That's something I'm still working on, but I would say probably not until my mid to late 20s, honestly. I also write in Eve's Blessing about until I was 25, I didn't know how to have an orgasm with a partner. So I had a lot of sexual insecurities. And I think that was also, you know, an inspiration behind the work I do, is to help other people work through things like that, because that really does affect your confidence when you're having sexual experiences where your partner's getting more out of it than you are. And so I think it was really when I delved into sexual exploration, doing things like sex educator training, sexological body worker training, which is a hands-on modality, and all those different things, receiving sex coaching, that I start to feel confident in my sexuality. And like I talk about in Eve's Blessing, feeling confident that my body was made for so much pleasure rather than being made for pain or pleasurelessness.
It's kind of odd, isn't it? It feels that when we first start having, maybe not even sexual thoughts, but when we first start exploring our own body, we could be super, super young, you know, as toddlers, as very young children, I mean, boys, I'm sure girls, you sort of got to, obsessed with their willy and whatever else, and it's like, look at this, and it's different, and their hands are down their shorts, whatever, and I think it still feels very early on that our parents or an aunt or a grandma, whatever, would say, that's dirty, and sort of slap our hands away, and I do think that the more I talk to experts like you, the more I feel that that has a big influence on how we feel about our bodies, and that we, once we get to puberty, we might start to masturbate, we might want to touch ourselves and give ourselves some form of pleasure. We often the orgasm is the goal. We're very, very hurried and we're scared that someone's going to come in the door. And my God, the shame of somebody sort of bursting in on us doing whatever we're doing. And it's, yeah, and as you just said it, until you actually get to an age where you feel comfortable exploring your body, I think it's hard to know what pleasure looks like with a partner if you don't know what pleasure looks like for yourself. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Well, people say that a lot. I think experiences differ. I've also worked with women who could orgasm actually only with a partner and not by themselves. So you more often hear about the former situation. But it is, it's taboo and it's considered less common or less natural for women to masturbate, which it's interesting because, yes, it's more normalized for boys. But if you read books like Nancy Friday, she writes about women's sexual fantasies and sexual experiences. You learn a lot of women like started masturbating at young ages or having sexual thoughts at young ages, but they just don't know who to talk to about it. And then later on, if you're like me, you find out that everyone else was doing it too. And it's a huge relief.
I mean, I look back maybe just even a couple of generations, thinking about my grandparents, and I can't ever imagine my grandparents talking about masturbation with each other or anything. And I can't imagine that my grandfather would have thought that my grandmother, his wife, ever did that. And I really think that generation was very much about sex was sadly something for, and this is phrasing it terribly, men to enjoy and women to endure. And hopefully that has completely changed now, but it still feels that there is almost some element of, if a woman's enjoying sex or talking about sex in a very progressive way, it still seems to be challenged by men and by society.
Yeah, I remember reading a quote. I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt actually, who said like, "Oh, that's something I just put up with" or something. Yeah. Which I'm looking this up if it was actually her. Because yeah, that is something a long time ago, like women didn't know. Yeah, it was that she was the one who said it was an ordeal to be endured. You know, I would guess she must have had some medical condition, maybe endometriosis, vaginismus, something like that. But like, because a lot of women don't talk about the fact that sex should never be painful, a lot of women with those conditions go undiagnosed because they don't realize that's a problem. Especially nowadays, I think pain during sex is not really considered normal, but it is still the first time or even the first few times. And that also does not have to be the case. And that also often does lead point toward possibly a medical condition, also possibly an issue like a lack of foreplay or arousal.
Yeah. So from your journey of, like, it wasn't until you really got into college or when you went to some different studies, and then when you got to your sort of mid-20s, what was the sort of journey from then to becoming the expert and knowing all of you? What was it that took this to becoming your profession?
There are a lot of different steps. I started writing about sex and relationships when I was like 24. Mm-hmm. I was working in marketing and was just bored, so just started writing stuff on the side. And that started to pick up, and publications were assigning things about sex and relationships. And I got a lot of cool opportunities. I got sent to clothing optional resorts. I got to go to sex parties. I got to take orgasm classes and workshops. And like, so that was my own personal journey. Not just learning to orgasm with partners, but learning to feel more comfortable in my body, learning different techniques, different ways of having sex, different sexual subcultures. And And then I think I wanted to do more work that was with people instead of just writing. So I did a sex educator training in like 2019, 2020, mm-hmm. started coaching. And then I wanted to help people even more. So I actually just started a job as a psychotherapist. I got my degree last year and a sex therapist. That's my specialty. So people, yeah, in California specifically, can look me up for psychotherapy. And yeah, I still do sex therapy and sex coaching for anywhere in the world.
I think one of the things that I really liked about Subjectified was that I think it laid very clear something that hopefully people are aware of, but perhaps not, that I think a lot of people maybe think that sex is something innate and we have our sexuality and that's who we are and it's part of who we are. But you make it very clear about how influential culture, society, and I guess religion, etc., is on how we feel about things. And I just wonder if you could talk to that a little bit about how yeah, society and the sort of cultural influences impacts how we feel we should behave or how we feel we should feel about certain things.
Yeah, it doesn't even just impact how we think we should be sexually. I think it shapes how we are. And yeah, that's not necessarily a problem. Even in animals, there's been studies, like there was a study when a rat was like wearing a jacket during sex, then it like got more turned on with the jacket on. Like there's all these cultural influences that shape our sexuality. And in this society, that often means in the kink community, you often see who are more submissive and men who are more dominant. Although actually a lot of people have fantasies that are the other way around. Yeah. But I do think there is an influence. And I talk about this in my book. In my personal experience, I'm writing against objectification, and yet I get turned on by being objectified. And that is like probably, you know, again, due to my culture. But if someone enjoys it, they shouldn't be deprived of it just because of that. But it is something to be aware of and something to play with. And and also a lot of people surprise themselves when they, like, for instance, our culture has a lot of compulsory heterosexuality. There's just this idea in the media, you know, that everyone is supposed to be straight. But a lot of people, if they start watching porn that isn't straight porn, or if they like expand their horizons, they realize they're more fluid than they thought. So there's definitely room to stretch yourself outside what your society teaches you that you are, but that influence is always there.
It's interesting you said about submissive and dominance there. So I've talked to a couple of dominatrix, I'm sure what the plural is, dominatrixes. Anyway, more than one dominatrix, who absolutely fabulous and incredibly insightful. And one of the things they say is when men come to them and want to submit for an hour or 2 hours, whatever, they say yes, it's partially about the sex, but then more of it is about the ability to just give control over to somebody else. And I think, and she said one of the reasons that men, married men in particular, come to them is that they feel very, very uncomfortable sharing this part of them with their partner. Because as you said, it's something that societally men are, it's a stupid word, supposed to be more dominant, and women are supposed to be more submissive. And yeah, so she said it's almost it's the guilt and the shame a little bit that brings men to them, because they can't talk to the person they've been with for 20, 30, 40 years. And how, in the sort of study and research that you've done, how do we help people break through the thought of a sexual desire being something to be ashamed of or be shameful?
I think just talking to people, just the more people you talk to, the more you realize that other people share your weird desire or your weird fantasy going online. I mean, if you look at websites, or there's a site called Literotica where everyone's like writing erotica, and you learn all the different fantasies people have. There's ethical porn sites. There's just a lot of resources online where you can like connect with other people. There's also apps like Plura and FetLife where people, I don't know if they have that where Plura, yeah, where you are, probably FetLife, yeah. Where, you know, you meet other sex positive people. And just the more people you talk to, the more you realize that every weird, like, fantasy, desire, kink you can think of, someone else has it. There's this idea, Rule 34 of the internet, it's from Hitchhikers of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. Like, if it exists, there is porn of it.
I love that. And I can almost validate that. I talked to somebody and she was, again, she helped people with their kinks and things. And she said that I thought she did everything, but there was, she had a guy that came to her and said he was obsessed with elevators. Not having sex in elevators, but just the history and beauty of elevators turned him on. And I thought of somebody being in an elevator and making the elevators go up and down was his kink. And she said, yeah, she hadn't found somebody else that had that one. But she said, in general, if you can think it exists, and you want to go online and think, oh, I thought it was the only one. And there's a club with 1,000 people that live literally 10 miles away from you or whatever. So it is fascinating. I hadn't heard that law before, but it does make complete sense.
I think I was wrong that that's not from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I think it's just an internet meme.
And it makes complete sense, though. Because, like, say, if you go on Lyserotica, the number of categories that exist on there, and the number of fantasies people have, and a lot of them are fantasies, because, I mean, a fantasy is different from a kink and is different from a fetish, I guess, and that fantasy isn't necessarily something that somebody wants to do exactly, but there are elements of it that turn somebody on. So I think as long as it's legal and not hurting somebody and it's consensual, then, yeah, that doesn't feel like there should be anything wrong with it. But I can totally understand why somebody that has been conditioned by society and has had their sexuality driven by what they're supposed to do, it's hard to sort of, yeah, bring those topics up, really. And I think it's particularly hard. And if you work with couples, how do you help them perhaps better communicate with one another? Because sometimes it's the person we are with for the longest. It's almost the hardest to share something with.
Hmm. How I help them communicate their fantasies.
Yeah. If a couple comes to you and they've been together 20 years and the sex life isn't quite what it was, and it's neither of them are very happy, and I guess there's something that each of them wants to sort of talk about, but they're nervous about sharing it for fear of being, I don't know, maybe mocked or to feel they're offended the other person. Yeah, how do you raise that in a conversation?
I think what's most important is everyone sharing their own experience without putting pressure on the other person. And I've worked with couples with mismatched desires, like one partner wants sex more than the other. That's actually the most common reason people go to sex therapy. Okay. And the best approach to that really is make sure, like, nobody blames the other, specifically the higher sex drive partner, is not to say, you know, you're failing to fulfill my desires, because there's probably a reason why the other partner does not have as high a sex drive. Maybe they're dealing with a medical condition. Maybe the sex they're having is not great for them. Like, maybe it's just focused on intercourse and there isn't enough foreplay. So it's really about just everyone sharing their experience and then meeting in the middle, not in the sense of anyone compromising their boundaries, but in the sense of, like, okay, why is this person wanting something different? Why is this person not in the mood for sex? And normalizing masturbation, or you know, if the couple wants non-monogamy, though, that's like not going to fix your relationship necessarily. And yeah, just encouraging people to share their emotions toward the experience rather than pointing fingers and saying, like, you know made me feel bad. It's more about, like, this really hurts and here's why, and maybe even sharing what is behind that trigger. Like, if there's earlier experiences that someone has that make them feel undesirable or whatever it is.
And I, as somebody that's one of my names, sort of mid-50s, my wife's not a dissimilar age. I guess as you get older, things happen or don't happen. You know, I might find it harder to get an erection. My partner might be going through perimenopause or menopause or whatever. So I think sometimes I think society is perhaps programmed, I'll say me, to think of sex as being penis in vagina. That's what sex is. That's successful sex. And I think I'm trying to think about now, if I try and replace the word sex with pleasure, it can feel very, very different. Because pleasure can be, I don't know, brushing somebody's hair or holding somebody's hand or stroking somebody's back or looking at somebody, for goodness sake. If you look at somebody for 2 minutes, how erotic and sensual is that? It doesn't, but I think somehow it's, oh my gosh, it's got to be sex, ejaculation, that's success. If I don't do that, then somehow I failed. And I really wish people would perhaps think about, well, what is pleasurable, as opposed to we've got to do this thing that sex has been defined as through the ages. And I think that's also what a lot of porn is about, is the act of sex itself, as opposed to thinking about what pleasure is. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to expand our minds, look at not just sexuality, but sensuality. For couples to connect sensually, like through giving each other massages, taking baths together. You know, there are some tantric activities like eye gazing. There's just a lot more out. There's a lot more out there for people than a lot of them realize. And sex does not have to involve penetration. And a lot of people, like from women, including women, a lot of gay men also say they prefer like oral sex over anal sex. And a lot of women say, I mean, a lot of lesbians like don't even engage in penetration. And we can also learn a lot from them that sex is not necessarily penis and vagina. That is part of it, but it's also better if we don't see that as the end all be all, because then there's a lot of pressure, a lot of performance pressure. Like you need to get an erection, you need to last a certain amount of time, you need to get wet, etc. And so it's important to just take the pressure off and realize that there are many ways to connect sexually. And then that actually makes penetration and intercourse better, because you are more relaxed and there isn't pressure on the situation.
Yeah. I think we've somehow got the wrong words in play that we like. See, talk about, we talk about foreplay as that. Well, this comes before what's going to happen, and foreplay can be the whole thing. And it's, yes, it is just getting away from that thought, really. And I interviewed an ethical porn director, and she was called Inka Winters, and she was fabulous. And a lot of her films are incredibly erotic and incredibly beautiful and very well filmed, whatever. But they're much more of a story. And she describes them as sort of feminist or ethical or just more sort of holistic porn, as opposed to the porn that most people will see on a lot of the clip sites. What would you define feminist sex as? Does such a term exist?
Does what exist?
Feminist sex. If somebody describes sex as being more feminist.
I think if you're trying to have feminist sex, that kind of takes the fun away. I forget who said this. There's a quote in one of Wednesday Martin's books, like, sex and politics make terrible bedfellows. Yes. I think like truly feminist sex is tuning into your body and just figuring out what you want in that moment and what feels good to you, like aside from any ideas you have about what is politically correct. And just everybody having a voice, having a say in the experience. Everything is not just consensual, but desired. And that there's consciousness and awareness of female pleasure, STIs, etc. But I think where it gets tricky is when you're like, the woman has to, be on top, or like anything specific like that, or like has to be dominant, or cannot feel like an object, or like has to have this many orgasms, or whatever the rule is. We don't want there to be any rules.
And I think some of the places where sex is talked about more openly. So you think about the kink community, BDSM, people have gone FetLife, we're sort of filling a survey to look at what are the things that they are into, not into, etc. And it's very visible. Whereas I sometimes think in the, this is probably the wrong word, in the more traditional sort of sexual world, we don't talk about stuff. We have sex, but whereas in the kink community or in BDSM, a lot of the eroticism is in actually negotiating or talking about things that you want to do, don't want to do, might want to do, safe words, etc. And I think it feels odd to say it, but we can learn a lot from the sort of kink community about actually we're talking about things. And so I don't want to be on top. Now, I do want to be dominated. Yes, I am an incredibly strong woman or an incredibly strong man, but I do want these to take me. I do want, and having those discussions as opposed to, yeah, just having almost sex by numbers. And so I really wish people would, yeah, so explore the conversation more deeply, I think, as well as, and you've said in your books about sort of sex and sexuality, it doesn't start in the bedroom. That's it doesn't even need to end in the bedroom, but it's sometimes we think, well, we're in bed now, okay, and that's the sort of start and end of it. And I think if we talk about it more, if people read books like yours and just understand what the conversation could be about, it'd be a lot more powerful, I think.
Yeah, I was just talking to my friend Josefina Bashout, who I interview in Eve's Blessing, about this idea of the orgasmic life, which she likes to say her life is like one giant orgasm because she just prioritizes pleasure. She prioritizes just things like dancing, eating good food, getting outside, playing with her partner, like being playful, being flirtatious. And I just like that attitude, you know, one giant orgasm. Some people take issue with the overuse of the word orgasm because think it should be scientifically defined. But I like the idea of like just seeing your whole life as a playground and a playground for erotic exploration, even if the erotic is something more expansive, something more just like you feel the wind blowing against your skin and it's a pleasant feeling. You know, the more we tune into those sensations, the more that they're accessible in the bedroom.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned food. I think there's so many similarities between indulging in food and indulging in pleasure. I mean, if you imagine eating a very ripe, beautiful, gorgeous, scented peach or mango or passion fruit, whatever. And if the pleasure you can take from that, if you allow yourself to be in a moment, not be eating it while you're on your phone and doing something else, just eating and absorbing it. Like I said, it's pleasure. I went to the beach the other day, just walked on the beach, which we don't do that often in the UK. And just the smell of the sea was extraordinary. And like you said, I almost allowed myself to feel pleasure from that. I probably wouldn't have described it as orgasmic, but I could feel the pleasure from it. And I sometimes think we sound a bit old now. We're so busy in our lives, we don't sort of sometimes it's just notice and accept those little pleasurable moments. And I think, yeah, I think that I'm sure that helps in our sexuality and our sort of sensuality and all sort of things. If we can just feel pleasure elsewhere. Mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned, you talked about quite a bit, is ethical non-monogamy. And I wondered, when does that feel like a solution people explore? Is it something that typically one person comes up with for another person? How do you manage the complexities of that?
Mm-hmm. I wish that were an option that were on the table for more people. I've written elsewhere about my experience in a relationship where I was cheating, and I really wish I could have just told my partner, look, you're not the one. Like, yeah. I want to keep exploring because I feel like there's something more, because that's so much of what relationships are when you're younger, is like you want to be with that person for now, but you kind of also like want to explore other options. And I think a lot of couples get into cheating scenarios because that's just not an option on the table. You know, sometimes they arrive at it when someone has already cheated, and that is a messy way to get there. But I've known couples who have done that, who have said, oh my gosh, I still love you, but I realize I'm not monogamous. And then the other partner might actually say me too. And, you know, that's great when a relationship can be salvaged that way. Otherwise, more often it's a couple that maybe just didn't know that was an option, and maybe they meet someone and they realize it is. And I recommend people ease slowly into that. I've guided couples to do things like make profiles on the app field and go through potential partners together and go on a three-way date and then see, you know, who there's chemistry with. And a lot of couples just really like that they don't feel so sexually limited just because they are in a relationship or even married. And There's also, though, a lot of feelings that can be triggered. So it's best to do that with support of a professional, like if jealousy or insecurity is triggered. And then you can either decide, you know, this is a limit of mine, or you can work through it. Okay, is this something I can work through if I gain reassurance that, you know, I don't feel as beautiful as this person, but maybe my partner can reassure me that I am. And, you know, maybe that's the wound that can be worked on. But I definitely don't recommend that anyone go into that, like past their comfort zone, to the extent that they are feeling traumatized, because it like brings up our deepest wounds when we feel this sense of jealousy and comparison. So I think if there is really good boundaries and there's reassurance and like the couple knows that they're strong and that they really love each other, like I've seen that really work out.
Do you think we're naturally monogamous?
I think it varies a lot from individual to individual. There is some evidence. I don't know if you've read the book Sex at Dawn. It's about the anthropology of human sexuality.
Yeah.
There is a lot of evidence for our hunter-gatherer ancestors not being monogamous. There's evidence of sperm competition, the idea that women actually had multiple partners at a time and their sperm actually like competed, as in killed other sperm and the best sperm won. There's a lot of evidence that non-monogamy is definitely in our DNA, that and I mean monogamy, there is a biological basis for that too. There's also research on I don't want to get this wrong, some kind of rodent, voles, I think prairie voles, that a hormone called vasopressin, males who release more of that are more likely to bond with one partner. And so there is variation within the human species as well. And I think like, if I were to say what is most natural, I would say that probably not the like traditional Christian way of like one partner for your whole life. But also, you know, some people, they do just prefer to have one partner, I think usually after having more than one to get there. And then there's a lot of people also who might be monogamish, who might have one partner, but also enjoy flirting with other people, or maybe they occasionally want to mix it up and have a threesome or something like that. And then there's a lot of people who would be non-monogamous if they knew how to actually navigate it. So I would say what's natural is probably, there's a large variation, but probably not as monogamous as we make it seem.
It was, and the reason I asked you, it was a topic that fascinated me when I first started hearing about it. And so I did the research and read the books that you talked about. And certainly historically, because there was much, much more, and we have this sort of saying today, it takes a village to raise a child, but historically, you know, going back sort of generations, that literally was the case. So, somebody would have a baby within a community, and it wasn't necessarily certainty about who the father was. And it didn't matter in a way, because the whole community would bring up the child. And then the same person might have a different child, could be with the same partner, a different partner. It didn't necessarily matter. Just the healthy procreation of the species was the goal, really. So I think once we got into that whole thing about property, this is my house, you're my wife, or my husband. And once we get into that whole property thing, it sort of changed a little bit, I think. But I do think people are wisely exploring other options now. And it's that notion that a lot of people have, that perhaps there's one person for us on the planet and that's it, which feels a bit old when there's 8 billion people out there. And also whether we, because we typically have more than one friend, because we get different things from different friends. And we get different. You might get something different from your brother or your sister or your aunt or your best friend or your schoolhouse friend or your college friend or whatever. But we have this one partner that has to be mother or father, has to be lover, has to be whatever. And it's hard. But as you say, it is having that discussion, really, in defining what monogamy is. For some people, you know, it would be wholly inappropriate to go out for coffee with somebody of the opposite sex, or to have somebody of the opposite sex, you know, as a friend you went away with for a, you know, went out for dinner with, they feel that was cheating. But I think for a lot of other people, it's, yeah, you can get something from different people. It doesn't have to be the one, as long as it's talked about. Because like you say, it is a difficult situation if you end up cheating, because that doesn't feel like a good thing. Because when that's found out, it typically doesn't ever end up well, really. One of the other things I did want to ask, and you've featured in lots of really high profile outlets and been on some really high profile podcasts and programs and things. Do you ever feel pressure to almost self-censor or package your ideas differently, or are you fully committed to, I'm Susanna, you know, take me as you find me and give what you want to say?
Good question. I think I definitely do. I feel pressure to self-censor. My cat is chiming in on this one.
You got an opinion as well. That's good.
Yeah, every editor has their own viewpoint. So I have been told things like you're being too sentimental, or because I'm such a romantic. So that's probably the biggest thing, is like to write about relationships from a more logical standpoint. And I'm also very spiritual. I like have worked a lot with psychedelics. So sometimes I want to bring that in, and that's not as accepted, but I think it's becoming more accepted, hopefully. And I'm looking forward to writing more things like that, that incorporate sexuality and spirituality.
I'm super glad you raised that. I find that whole topic absolutely fascinating. The sense of, depending on what you mean by spirituality, I guess. So for me, spirituality is the fact that our bodies are the current casing we have for the energy that we are. And I think our energy goes on, it goes into the universe and transmutes whatever. And I think when I've talked to people that have worked with different psychedelics and experienced, whether it be mushrooms or it be the other extreme, ayahuasca, or lots of different things, just that they've been able to almost understand more by using psychedelics carefully. I'm not trying to advocate for anything illegal, but just that there's so much of our mind, our brain, our somatic self that we can't access currently. So if there are these amazing herbs, which they are plants basically, that exist for thousands of years, you just feel that it's something we should be exploring a lot more. I think one of the challenges is it's something that Big Pharma can't commercialize. So they've just been sort of banning it, really. So what are your thoughts on psychedelics and how they potentially open us up to, a bigger and broader sense of ourselves? Gosh, that's a big question. No, but just you raising it, I just find the whole thing absolutely fascinating, and I'm so curious about it.
Yeah, that's also a topic I've written about, mainly for the site Double Blind and Vice. Psychedelics, I'm obviously an advocate. I've benefited a lot, not just mentally, but physically. They've helped with certain symptoms. I have chronic Lyme disease, and actually like very few Western medicine treatments worked at all, but plant medicines such as Cambo and Iboga actually helped me a lot. I would just say like it should be done. People who use psychedelics recreationally, I think more often have bad experiences. I think if someone's a beginner, especially, they should do it under the guidance of a facilitator. And not that every mushroom trip has to be done that way, but I like to err on the side of caution. Yeah. And these people also need to understand that integration is a big part of the experience, meaning that afterward, when you come back, there may be a period of time where you're a little disoriented or confused, or maybe the trip, I've actually had this experience where the trip continues and you're still kind of hearing things, and that is not that uncommon. But if you don't have proper support, sometimes from like a shaman, because Western medicine sometimes like calls that mental illness. There's just often a lot of support needed to not just go through the experience, but integrate it and actually make meaning of it. And then reorganize, restructure, change your life because of it, rather than leave it as a story in the past.
Yeah, everything I talk to says having a guide and somebody that can almost help you understand and embrace what you've experienced. And there's a big difference between, yeah, getting some mushrooms from a guy outside a Walmart than there is in going to sort of spend time with somebody that has studied it, because like it is plant-based, but it's some people I talk to, it is incredibly strong. It can be very confusing sometimes until somebody explains it, or like you say, figures out, well, how do I embrace that into my life? Because some people, I guess, go through potentially events or experiences where they want to make big changes. And that's if you don't make the change after having experience, it feels like a bit of a waste, really. Do you think that might be something you would address in a future book? I know you've probably toiled and sweated blood, sweat and tears to get the two books out, but is there more books in you? Are there more books in you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm not exactly sure what my next book is. I'm working actually on a nonfiction erotica series about an experience meeting someone in a psychedelic trip, like having visions of him and then him showing up in reality. And then it's about our relationship as it continues both in the dream space and reality, which includes like sexual experiences I had on psychedelics where he actually came in and played with me. So yeah, there's a lot. And then there's also something I'm starting that's about sexual healing through psychedelics and how psychedelics help me let go of ancestral trauma and different factors that were making me feel like not at home in my body. And how DMT especially opened up my sexual potential. I started to realize I could experience things like touch-free orgasm and whole body orgasm, and how much trauma was keeping me from that, because women have all of this ancestral trauma around women's sexuality being punished and shamed. So that's like an idea in my head that I want to write about, but it's just in the beginning.
I think the nonfiction would be fabulous. Just, yeah, I love the idea of stepping into an experience and act, is this real? What is real? Is it virtual? Is it? Yeah, that'd be so interesting just to read about how that feels and what that felt like, etc. And just like I say, how it allowed you to open up and recognize that there were things that were holding you back, really. Which I guess all people, and particularly women, have those things that hold them back. And it's only when they read somebody else's story, I think, well, Susanna's a regular person, you know. She's why aren't I feeling like this? And then hopefully they go and then explore, then maybe talk to you or another expert and think, well, how can I start to have non-touch or full body or different sorts of feelings, really? I did want to touch briefly on your work as a doula, which I guess is connected but separate. I've always thought it is such an amazing thing to do. And thank you for doing it. Having had two children and been through the sort of traditional way we experience birth in the UK, I'm sure it's not too different in the US. It certainly isn't a rephrase that. It's certainly something where the discussion is, right, we're going to try and limit the pain as much as possible, but this is going to be incredibly painful for the wife or partner or whatever. I wouldn't even dream of saying I felt any pain through it. But how does the work that you've experienced as a doula help people experience birth in a very different and more positive way?
I've done certifications in ecstatic and orgasmic birth, which is a totally different framework from the usual medicalized view of childbirth. A good resource is the Orgasmic Birth documentary, Orgasmic Birth, The Best Kept Secret. There's also a book called Orgasmic Birth. People think this is a crazy idea, so it doesn't necessarily mean having an orgasm during childbirth. It's more about making it's more about making it a pleasurable experience. And there's this idea that birth should not be something that is always forced into a medical system. Sometimes it needs to be. Sometimes there is a high-risk pregnancy. Yeah. But there is research showing that for low-risk pregnancy, birthing at home or at a midwife center is just as effective. And you know, with an environment that is more relaxing and more positive. And people who advocate orgasmic and ecstatic birth often use techniques like birthing outside or birthing in a pool of warm water, which relaxes mm-hmm. your muscles and is a pain reliever, incorporating things like candles and music to make it a positive environment, and learning how to breathe through the contractions and use noise and movement to release tension. And that some people say when they do that, they can get to a point where they no longer are afraid of pain. And if they feel discomfort, they can breathe through it. And actually on the other end is pleasure if they do not have fear and do not clench. And so this is something, you know, that is just starting to be talked about, but I think, and some people feel judged by it because they're like, oh no, if I can't do that, am I failing at giving birth? We don't live in a world that's really set up for great childbirth experiences a lot of the time. And so at the same time, it is possible for a lot of people to have a much better experience than we're told. And I talk about this in my book, Eve's Blessing. There's the curse on Eve, thou shalt bring forth children in sorrow. And I think that curse is largely cultural, not biological. There are a lot of unnecessary interventions for some people giving birth. And there's also a lot of fear and anxiety surrounding the process and just a lack of freedom and lack of choice for people giving birth. Mm-hmm. And there is, I recommend that people research orgasmic and ecstatic birth. And the same things I said about sex, about creating an orgasmic life, that also applies to birth, that the more you recognize and learn how to feel more pleasure in your body, the more you can then bring that to the birth experience. Some people also literally masturbate during childbirth to like take the focus off pain and include pleasure. And it can also jumpstart labor. So people should be given this information.
Yeah, that's I think that's incredibly valuable to hear, because I think a lot of people feel very, very, very much under pressure from the medical industry. And I'm not, this is not blaming doctors or nurses or midwives. They want to do a good thing, but incredibly resource light, and they're running from one room to another, and it's a very white, super sterile area that you have no ownership of, and you want to bring in, and you can't have candles in here because we've got oxygen, you can't do this, you can't do that. But it's if you look at most mammals when they give birth, they if given the space, they create their own space. They physically create almost a nest to give birth in. They give birth, they immediately lick their babies clean and bond with them so quickly, whereas often our babies are rushed away from us and they're swaddled up in blankets and things, and it becomes, you almost sort of separated before you even started. So I do think there should be a lot more, it would be wonderful to think there's a lot more pleasure to come from the birth as well as the results of the birth. So I think, anything that can raise that conversation is, something definitely worth exploring much more. Are there major things that you feel have changed in your life in the last decade? What do you feel the biggest differences between here you are now and the person you were when you sort of finished college?
Wow.
how long have we got? Yeah. But what are the really big things?
The first thing that came to mind, this is funny, is that I define myself less by my mind and more by my body, which is like not my parents' brand of feminism. I think like I used to be very career oriented and very interested in proving my intelligence and my success and my power. And now my goal is more to live a life that is free and to live a life. I've explored a bunch of other things like doing OnlyFans and doing different kinds of sex work and just like being more free in my body and my sexuality, and realizing that life is not to be lived entirely in the mind. And it's not I used to really pride myself just on my output, my productivity. And now I think I pride myself more on my well-being and like my happiness. So, and I think a lot of that was due to psychedelics and just questioning my parents' values. And I like to say that I'm a daughter of God and a grandchild of the plants, because that's what ultimately working with plant medicine does. It helps you see a new God, and actually you almost are parented by the plants rather than by your parents and your ancestors and their trauma and their programming. And like my particular ancestral programming was like work hard, work hard. And I feel like that's the big thing I'm like getting rid of.
So have you learned to be, not learned to be comfortable, but almost learned to take pleasure from men looking at you and thinking you're sexy and hot and knowing that you're turning them on? Do you embrace the pleasure that gives you, as opposed to feeling I shouldn't feel pleasure at men looking at me and addressing me with their eyes or whatever?
There are different ways that men can look at a woman. And I say this in subjectified, there's a difference between the male gaze, which is a critical theory concept of an objectifying gaze where a man breaks a woman into pieces, where women are portrayed in the media as pieces of meat, versus a man's gaze, which can include mental and emotional appreciation as well, which can include seeing you as a human being and appreciating you for your beauty, not just your beauty, but really something like being a cam model or a porn performer. It is a type of performance and, or really any kind of sex work. It involves skill, it involves embodiment and empowerment and sort of a certain grace and confidence. And so I think there's like many layers and aspects to this question of the male gaze, and it does not necessarily mean an objectifying gaze. It can mean appreciating you for everything, including your physical beauty, which also comes from, you know, your sense of comfort in your body and your confidence. And so, yeah, I would say the idea of being an object for the gaze has become less scary for me, and it's also about much more than that.
So I've talked to people with the OnlyFans platform, sex workers, people that work in the porn industry, actresses and things. And a lot of the things that they've said, particularly about OnlyFans and Fansly and lots of places like that, is that what they enjoy, I think, is the control, really. So they can decide what to show and what to do and who to talk to and who not to talk to. And when I've sort of interviewed them and talked to people, it's typically the people that talk and have a conversation are incredibly respectful and are interested and are generous and are, yes, turned on, etc. But they look at the person, and I think it helps with platforms like that to recognize that there's a person there as well as a performer, if that makes sense. So, yes, they can look at the body and think, oh my God, that person's so hot, whether it be a man or a woman. And yes, but then, as you say, you can also be turned on by the things a person says. And if you don't like what somebody's saying to you as somebody, and a subscriber or whatever, just cut them off. So I think that has started to empower people more, the OnlyFans type model, where you have more control than you do with porn, for example, where you create it might create a great environment, but you're not sure what happens with it. But I think that a whole ability to own ourselves and how that is then portrayed to people is super valuable. And it feels like it's becoming, it's such a stupid word to use, almost more respectable. It's more recognized as a very professional industry now, and safer and more secure. And it gives people a good living. A lot of people that perhaps would have struggled to do other things, it gives people ownership over how they decide to make their living. How do you personally find the time and energy to do all the things that you do? I mean, I won't list them all off again, but at the beginning it was, and he does this, and he does this, and he does this. How do you almost look after your own mental and physical well-being so you can do all this stuff?
Well, I do things that I genuinely enjoy, so I'm intrinsically motivated. That's like what stops me from being drained. But I also do a lot of self-care. I live right by the beach, so I go to the beach a lot. I love going to the sauna, cryotherapy. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yeah.
And I'm in LA, so I do a lot of things like that, yoga, meditation. Mm-hmm. I try to leave at least the last 2 hours of every day to do something that's not work.
Fabulous. My last question, if that's okay, is, are you a planner? Do you know what the next 5 and 10 years are going to look like? Do you have a vision for the future? Do you have an ambition for the future?
My ambition for the future is to be with my soulmate and make art with him and write books with him and make porn with him. That's what I really want. I have been doing what I'm doing as a single person for a while, and I want to be done with that.
So you actively seeking a soulmate now?
I think I know who he is, but he hasn't. We're not officially a couple yet. So
does he know?
I think he's getting comfortable with the idea. He's I can't say too much yet, but no. I really hope if he's listening, he knows that that's what I would like to do.
Well, if he's listening, get a bloody move on. There's a lot of people would love to be in your shoes, buddy. So yeah, we'll see how. That'd be fabulous. I really hope that happens very soon. And you just managed to keep doing the things you're doing. So I'm fascinated by the next books that are coming out. Can't wait to read about the ones about sort of psychedelics and your journey through those and your experience. But it really feels like you really embrace life. And I think that's such a good thing to do. I think we, like you said before, we're almost programmed to work. And there's no harm in that. Of course you've got to work. But if you can work at something you enjoy, how much more joyful life is if you can do things that you know are bringing you succor and happiness and comfort and joy, then that's a good place to be. Thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. And I hope people enjoy listening to what you've had to say.
Thank you.